tonight will be the last time we visit, at least for this series of sermons, the text in Ephesians that we've been looking at for 2 months. So if it's your first night, you're coming in at the end of something. And if you've been here all along, tonight, my hope is to wrap up what we've been spending our time thinking about. And whether you're here for the first time or you've been here all along, I really do believe that there will be something for you tonight, not directly through me, but because God is present when we meet and when we think on Him and when we genuinely open ourselves up. And so tonight, I want you to grab one of the Bibles there on your chair, and I want you to find Ephesians chapter 4. And when you find Ephesians chapter 4, just get to the first verse, and I'm going to read what we've been spending our time on, and then I'm going to talk about it in three steps. And this is on page 951, in case you haven't found it just yet. Chapter 4, verse 1 and following reads like this. I, therefore, the prisoner in the Lord, beg you to lead a life worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love, making every effort to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. These short three verses have been our subject for 2 months. Each week we've spent time looking at each one of the characteristics, and there are six of them that Paul listed there to be descriptive of the church, the community that is living a life worthy. Humility, gentleness, patience, bearing with one another in love, making every effort to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. If you were here the first night, I hope you remember that the phrase live a life that is there in our English translation comes from the Greek word which means to walk. What Paul said when he spoke to that first group was, walk worthily of the calling to which you've been called. And this text, therefore, is about walking. And what he says worthy walking looks like are those six attributes. And we've spent 1 week each on each one of those. And what I want to do tonight to wrap this up is simply come back one last time to the image of walking. If you recall, there were three things that I said that were instructed in this image of what it's like when a person walks that can help us. I said that at the start, and tonight I want to bring us back to all six of these by spending a little bit of time on each one of those three elements of walking. Walking is something that we do in the public. Walking is something that is slow. And walking is something that we do on purpose. Before we go to that, I would like to add to Carrie's prayer my own. And so I'll ask you to pray with me. God, tonight we come to the end of a series in which we've been hoping to hear what it means for us to walk worthily of the calling. God, when you came near in Christ and dwelt among us, you made it plain to the disciples that your task for them, the thing that you had given them to do, was to bear witness to who you were. That is, to walk through life so that when people looked at them, they would see you. God, I pray that all that we've learned in these last weeks would become fresh in our minds again tonight. And as we seek to wrap it up, that you would teach us what we need to hear tonight. Not so that we can go away a bit happier or more glad, but so that we can become worthy of the calling, which is to show this world that so desperately needs to see who Jesus is, what he is like, as we learn to walk worthily. I pray that you'd help us do that tonight. In Jesus' name, amen. One. Walking is something that is done in public. When Paul wrote these words, or spoke these words to the people in this congregation, walking was not something that you did in church. Walking was not something you did in the privacy of your own home. Rather, walking was something that you did out in the open, on the public roads that everyone else was free to walk on. Paul knew that. And he knew that when he told these people that they were responsible for being humble and patient and gentle and loving and working for unity, that what he was telling them was that they needed to go about in front of other people in the world in such a way that they could see all of these attributes. Because walking is something that people do in public. I'll tell you a story. On Monday, I went to a picnic. Anyone else do that? Memorial Day? If you did, give me some form of human response. Yes. Okay. So a few fists. I was invited to a party. And I came to the party with my own board game. And it's a board game called Settlers of Catan. It's a few chuckles because you know that this is a board game for geeks. And you have to be pretty secure to mention this in front of a group. Okay? I brought my own Settlers of Catan game. Arrived at this party, and it was put on by some folks, a couple from our church, from this church. I'm so glad that they invited me and included me to their get-together. And I was thankful when I arrived to notice that there were not just people from our church there, but strangers too. I was glad. Sat down, started socializing a bit, chatting. I really just wanted to get to the game of Settlers. Small talk was done. I sat down, and we started to gather around the game. Now, there were some youngsters there and some older folks and whatever. There's one girl who decided that she wanted to play. Now, I'm about 9 times older than this girl. And when she asked to play, I said yes. I knew it would increase my chances of a victory. We sat down around the board. And in this game, each person is a specific color. Now, she said, I want to be red. This is how I responded. I said, no, you cannot be red. I am always red. You are not going to be red. Do you know how she responded to that? She burst into tears. And loudly so. And now all eyes in the whole place are on me as I'm sitting across from this girl. Now, any objective person could see that I wasn't terribly gentle in this moment. Looked over the side, and I noticed that some of those folks that had been invited to the party, they were also among those who were staring at me. You know, I remembered in that moment, as I looked at them as they stared at me, that I had overheard the host of the party telling them, hey, that's our pastor over there. That was earlier on. I heard it. I tried to pretend that they weren't saying it. I kind of like, yeah. That's okay. I look over. These were folks, by the way, who had been invited. These are people that they had met at the gym and on the train on the way to work, and they invited him into their party. No doubt, in hopes of doing what I've said over and over again to this group of people over the months that have passed, that we ought to bring ourselves into contact with people who will be able to look at us and look at the way we're gentle and patient and kind so that they'll get to see who Jesus Christ is. I've said that. They did that. There they were, looking at me as I was just so ungentle that this poor girl was bursting into tears. I just wanted her to stop. I looked over, and the one guy, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure as he looked at me, he said, way to go, Pastor. I think he just mouthed the words. But listen. Walking is something we do in public. Those words that I read and you followed along with. Humility. That is something that people will be able to see in you, or they'll see its opposite. Gentleness is something that when others who are out in the world that we're out in, they'll look at us and they'll either see that we're gentle or not. The same goes for all of the rest of those things. Patience. Impatience is something that others can see in you. And whether or not we're willing to bear with one another in love, or whether we work together for unity and peace, or on the other hand, whether we're ready to dismiss people who are different and not like us in hatred, or do what we can to divide ourselves away from people who make us uncomfortable, or whether we're always adding on to fights. Walking is something that we do in public. And it matters so much because what people see in the way that we relate to each other and in the way that we relate to outsiders, it speaks volumes and way louder so than any words we can say. We can have the most eloquent expression of how loving God is. And we could speak of it in words that would make anyone's ears ring. That would be so beautiful. But unless we love each other, really, it won't mean anything at all to hear our words about how loving God is. We can, as a group, we can know everything there is to know about Jesus' resurrection. We can be confident that he rose from the dead on Easter. We can have all of the facts, all of the historical facts together. We can have a clear sense of the background of that world view in that time and understand how it was that people believed in this. And we can have the most compelling argument to back up our idea of the resurrection. So much so that if we went to a court of law, we could win a case on it. But unless the risen Jesus Christ himself is seen ruling among us, those arguments won't mean anything. I could stand here and talk with every ounce of authority and strength and gift that God has given me about how welcoming God is in Christ. I could show you all of the texts in the Bible that prove that God is so welcoming. I could win that argument. But unless this group is genuinely and truly welcoming to other people, not just the ones that are fun to be with, not just saying hello on Sunday night, but actually maybe having dinner together afterwards, inviting strangers over, being with people who are unbearable. Unless we do those things, all of the words about love are utterly meaningless. And all of this follows from the truth that walking is something that happens in public, and people see, and what they see matters immensely. That's number one. We've been at this now, by the way, for 6 weeks, talking about humility and patience and gentleness and so on. Has anyone here found, like me, that one of the consequences of this series is that you're more aware of the growth that you need in every one of these areas? Yes? Yeah. Now, it's tempting. And I think in that moment where I failed in that party, and in the many other moments in the last 6 weeks, even tonight, where I failed to be patient when I ought to have been patient, or failed to bear with somebody, it's very tempting to look at the challenge and to say, I have to give up. This is impossible. I can't possibly do this. I can't grow in these ways. It's too difficult. It's too challenging. I'm going to give up. The second thing about the image of walking that ought to save us from that mistake is to remember that walking is slow. Walking is a process. When a person in those days, when Paul spoke, had a destination in mind and they had to walk there, they had that goal in mind and they knew that they weren't going to get there all at once. They had to walk. That meant one step in front of the next, in front of the next. And that took a long time. And I'm confident, I believe this, that Paul chose the image here of walking because he knew that moving from impatience in life toward patience, or moving from a place where you're very angry all the time and you react and you want revenge, to the place where you're gentle, or moving from the place where all you care about is yourself because you're so arrogant and afraid and insecure, to a place where you're humble, Paul knew that that takes a long time. It takes one step after the next. Please, if any one of you has found in these 6 weeks that now you're more aware of some of these issues, be encouraged that you're starting to see the things you need so that the next step you can do a bit better and you can keep moving along. For every one of us who has seen the places where we need to grow, here's an exercise that I want to do. Some of you take notes. I want you to write something down now. If you don't take notes, here's what I want you to do. Use your mind for a moment. Imagine you have a note card, a piece of paper in your brain right now. Mine's right up here. You got it? The note card. Where are the areas where you need to grow? And here's the question I want every one of you to think of. What is it in your environment, whether it's people or circumstances, events, what is it in your environment that makes it hard for you to be humble, patient, gentle, loving, to work for unity and peace? If you're taking notes, I want you to write down the things in your environment that make it hard for you. If you're not, on this mental brain paper, mental brain paper. Got it? I'm going to try to market this. Okay, nobody's going to buy it. You know, can I share something? I was envious when they were cheering for you, Chris. I wish I got some sort of response when I preached.
Ow!
Yes. Okay. I want you to answer this question, those of you who take notes, and if you're not taking notes in your brain, here it is, ready? In your environment, what are the things that make it really hard for you to be patient? I want everybody to actually get this in your brain. Is there anyone who'd be willing to share with everyone else what it is for them? Anybody? Would somebody do that? Yes.
Family.
Family makes it hard for you to be patient.
School
has all kinds of opportunities for impatience, yes.
Driving
and your job. Okay, good. Everyone else gets one of these in your head. You got it? Okay, let's go to the next one. What is it in your environment that makes it really difficult for you to be gentle? It's something that happens that instead of wanting to forgive and wait and be calm, you want to fight back and retaliate. Has anyone got something they share? Something that makes it hard, like a girl who wants to be read when you want to be read at Settlers of Japan. Actually, I shared that. Yeah, go ahead.
When someone's disrespectful to you.
Okay, thank you for being honest and sharing it. You know, you might think, oh, I could say, but I'd be embarrassed because I'm probably the only one who struggles with this. It's funny how we go along through life trying to hide what we think is unique to us as a fault, and when in fact all the people around us have faults that they're doing the same way. I'm going to give you a chance to think through these other ones. What is it that makes it hard for you to bear with people in love? Something about another person that's so unbearable to you. What is it specifically for you? Or what is it that makes you want to divide up away from people instead of working for unity? It makes you want to cut that person off and push them away. Or what is it for you that makes you want to make war instead of peace? I'm asking you to look at these for this reason. Listen. We all should know that walking is slow. We should look at the places where we're strong, definitely, and work toward those. If you're really good at being patient, be patient out there in front of other people. But on the other hand, there are times to stop and look at the places where we're really deficient so that we can grow. And that's what we're doing right now. This is not so that when we're done in church here, we can have had this experience just here. It's so that when you leave, you have some attention in your own mind about what are the things out there that really make it hard for me to walk worthily. Remember, it's slow. Now, there's one last thing. Could you show this a bit more, Chris? For this one, I have some slides. Because I want to teach you something that I'm sure will be helpful for you. Walking is something that's in the public eye. It's out there. It's also something that is slow. The third thing about walking is that it is something that happens on purpose. It's something that we do on purpose. Everything that a person does on purpose is something that they can improve upon. It's something that involves a choice. And there are so many times when I walk unworthily and act as if I had no choice in the matter. And I promise you that you do the same thing all the time. There are so many times where I do not walk worthily and I act as if walking is not on purpose. I had no control over my outburst of impatience. I had no control over the angry word that I spoke rather than a loving one. Oh, why? It's just too much. Because I haven't learned enough about... Get ready for this. Stimulus and response. Now this is going to be some learning. Okay? And it's going to be fun. And even though it's fun, you're going to learn something. Ready for this? Anybody know who this guy is? Don't call out. If you know, you keep that answer in your mind. It's a guy with a sweet beard and mustache, that's for sure. Here's a hint. Ready? This might help you understand who he is. This is a painting. Watch now. Don't shout out if you know the answer. Yes, that says, "I love dog drool." Anybody know who he is? Yes, Pavlov. Anybody know his first name? Gosh, I am Ivan Pavlov. That's a cartoon drawing of Ivan Pavlov. Very good, Kathleen. This is why I'm showing you Pavlov. Because Pavlov did this to dogs. Now, I'm going to need a laser pointer because this is pretty complicated, but trust me, there's a reason why we're looking at this together. All right? This is a dog. And the dog, this right here, is a dog holster. These are tethers or fetters, leather bands, designed to constrain an animal or beast in a solitary position. This is a dog. This right here, anybody want to take a gander at what that is?
Meatloaf.
Food, meatloaf, perhaps. Alpo. This right here is a mechanism or a machine. And this is a tube, and it's going into the dog's mouth. You know why? Saliva. Ivan Pavlov was a scientist who was obsessed with saliva. Actually, that's not the point. Pavlov studied dogs. And what he noticed was that when a dog saw food, it started to drool. It had a stimulus, it's food, and it began to have a response to food. Pavlov began to feed dogs ordinary food, and then he began to do something else. He started putting chili powder on dog's food. Did you know that? Chili powder, yeah, chili powder. He covered the dog food with chili powder one day, and guess what happened to the volume of saliva? It increased. You know, when I talk about chili, is your mouth watering?
Yeah.
Chili powder. Is it watering more? Yeah. He noticed that if he set a dog, or if he fed the dog regular food, it salivated a certain amount. If he fed it food with chili powder, it salivated more. But then he recognized this, that if he showed the dog some regular food, it salivated a certain amount. It went down this little pipe, and he measured how much saliva came out. Then he covered the food with chili powder and showed it to the dog again, and guess what? More saliva. He noticed that even if the dog didn't eat the food, anticipating a different spiciness changed the response in the dog. Got it? Okay. This is what he learned from this. Okay, this is a little diagram. He noticed, now you can't see it, but this right here is a bone, a dog bone, food. He noticed that when food, this bone, was showed to the dog, it responded by salivating. And what he called this was, he said that the bone, the food, was the unconditioned stimulus. Stimulus and response. A stimulus is some event or item or occurrence that is within our environment that's right there. The bone for the dog is an unconditioned stimulus. And what he found was every time a dog saw this stimulus or it experienced this stimulus, it always had the same response. That's what that R stands for. An unconditioned response for the dog was that when it saw the food, it salivated. Now, Pavlov also knew that if he rang a bell is another what? Stimulus. If he rang a bell in front of that dog, no saliva came out. See this dog? No saliva. You got it? Next, Pavlov thought, if I can make a dog salivate more by putting chili powder on top of his food, what if I ring the bell every time the dog eats? And then one day stop giving the dog food to keep ringing the bell. What'll happen? So for a long time, every time he fed the dog, he rang the bell. Anybody see The Office, by the way?
Yeah.
You don't know about television show Office, I'm sorry for sharing an insight, but it's modern day example. With the window sound and outputs and bad breath. Eventually Pavlov took the food away, rang the bell, and even though there was no food there, the dog still responded as if there were going to be food by salivating. And what he called this was, the bell was a conditioned stimulus, because he over and over again rang the bell every time the dog was going to get food, and what he received from the dog was a conditioned response. That is to say, every time a bell rang, the dog would salivate, because Pavlov had discovered that animals have this sort of pattern when it comes to stimulus and response. And the pattern is very simple. Every time there is a stimulus, you have the same response. And the dog doesn't choose this, it just happens. It's unconditioned. It's conditioned. It gets to the point where every time it hears a bell, its mouth waters, and it can't choose anything different. This stimulus, ringing bell, equals this response. You see the connection between stimulus and response for dogs. That was one of the things that Pavlov discovered. It's quite beautiful. Now, I'm not just sharing this because it's about dogs. This, you know what this is? It's a cute little bell with a rainbow. This is a stimulus. This is some event or occurrence or person or experience in our environment. Maybe it's a sunny day instead of a rainy day. Maybe it's a mean teacher instead of a kind teacher. Maybe it's someone who's driving in a way that you don't like on the highway. Maybe it's an unkind word uttered right to your face. Maybe it is a relationship that you desperately want to work that is failing because the other person is being irresponsible. Maybe it is a child that just won't cooperate with what you desire. Maybe it is a rift that is developing in a family because someone is utterly selfish. This is any one of the things that's on the list that you note-takers were taking, or those of you who are using the brain post-it notes or whatever I call them. It's whatever on there, a stimulus. Got it? This, you know what this is? It is. It does happen to be Arnold Schwarzenegger, but that's not what I'm getting at. This is a response. Right? Now, if you're not here and you're listening on the internet, you're missing a beautiful picture of Arnold Schwarzenegger freaking out. We record these for people who aren't here. The way it generally works for us people is that every time we have a particular stimulus in our environment, it leads to a certain response. Now think for a moment. In your own life, are there stimuli in your life that always lead to the same response? Just so we got the connection, I want one more exercise. You ready? Look at this picture. You see this picture? Let's try this together. What would you say the response is that you see here?
Frustration.
Is that a good word for this? Everyone agree? Frustration, okay? Someone else. What's the stimulus? Computer, what else? Someone said lightning bolts. Lightning bolts and computer. Ready? In this case, we have the stimulus, which is the broken computer, leading to the response, which is frustration and freaking out. All right. You got this now, the connection between stimulus and response.
Listen now. When Paul wrote his letter to the Ephesian church and he told them about humility, leave that off for just a moment, sorry. He told them about humility and he told them about patience and he told them about love and gentleness and unity and peace. Do you know what he was talking about with them? He was talking about their responses. He was telling them how they ought to respond. He was telling them that you ought to respond in situations where you might feel a surge of arrogance or selfishness. You ought to respond with humility. He was telling them that when you experience or encounter something that makes you want to fight back and destroy the other person, you should respond in gentleness. He was saying, when you are confronted with something that makes you want to lash out and be utterly impatient and push the other person who is demanding something of you, that you wait for them and that you be patient with them. When you feel that, you should respond in patience, and so on. He was telling them about their responses and what they ought to look like. Now, I want you to see this. When we, as people, and when I, as a person, when I'm aware of the fact that the responses that are sort of characterizing my daily life, when I see that there are responses that I wish were different, do you know what I tend to do and what we often tend to do? To account for why our responses are as they are, do you know what we do? We do this. We say, the fault for my responses lies with all of these stimuli, the stimulus around me. That's why I can't be patient. That's why I can't bear with that other person, because they're unbearable. That's why I can't be humble, because that other person makes it too hard. What we do to account for our failures in responses is that we draw these little lists up that we've all drawn up, that you've drawn up, and that I have in my own mind. We point to them and we say, this is the reason for these bad responses. It's these stimulus. Now, there's a couple reasons why this is so deadly. The first reason is that the stimuli that cause these responses, do you know what is true about them? We don't control them. I don't control the traffic. I don't control the weather. I don't control the other person who comes up to me and says something cruel. The person who I love and am in a relationship with, I don't control them. The people that God has brought together into this church, who are in this community with me, I can't control them. And you can't control them. You can't control the people around you. You can't control what school is like when it's bad. You can't control all of the things around you that keep impinging upon you. And as long as you try to change your bad responses by focusing your energy on the stimuli around you, you will just continue to go into places of deeper and deeper frustration. You'll become more and more frustrated, you'll become bitter and jaded, and you'll push people away from you. And you'll decide what most people in our culture decide, and that is this, that the secret to having the right responses and being happy is to isolate myself. Because real life is full of too many things that make it hard for me to be what I should be. That's so sad that that happens. There's another reason why that is so utterly foolish. And it's this. This pattern right here is true for dogs. It's true for animals. Because animals can't control this arrow. A dog can't change the fact that when the bell rings, and it's been treated this way all along, that there's an automatic arrow that pushes it right to the same response every time, and there's nothing it can do about it. And when we act like the problem with us and the responses that we don't want to have is all around us, we're acting like animals. And the truth is this, that for human beings, there is not an arrow between stimulus and response. There's not. It's just not there. And you might, I tell you, this is a hard thing for us to believe because our experience over the course of our lives is so conditioned us to believe that the problems that we experience are out there. I'll give you an example. Someone says a terrible word to us, a cruel thing right to our face, and our response could be to fight back and say something mean right back to them. We say, I couldn't help it. I just had to do that. Do you realize that speaking is a voluntary action? It involves choice. Okay, you say yes. Well, okay, maybe I could have held my tongue and not responded. Yeah, I could have chosen not to say anything. And then I go off by myself, and at home, I brood over the thing they say. I think about that mean word. It stews around in my mind, and I dwell on it. I keep coming back into my mind. As I lie down to go to sleep that night, I let my mind think about it over and over again. Then I start to believe that mean thing that person said. I hold it inside. I start to look at myself as if what they said is true about me. Then I become so despondent and sad, I give up. I isolate myself. I want to be alone. I become depressed. Do you know that between that stimulus and that response, you know what was in between those two? It wasn't just an arrow. It was a series of choices. That is what is between the stimulus, every stimulus that you experience, and every response that you give as a human being. There is not an arrow in between. There is a choice. It goes for when someone says something mean to you. Let's say you lose your job. Could you control that stimulus? No. You might think, well, a person loses their job, the only thing that they have to do is just to get really upset and freak out about it and worry and get anxious and then to start, going back into their home, beating their head against the wall. No, there's a choice. When that happens, you can choose how to respond. That is what it means uniquely to be a human being, that you can choose how you respond to the stimulus in your environment. I tell you right now, that I am absolutely certain this is true. And I'll tell you why I know it. Actually, I'll ask you this. Has anyone in here ever been with a person whose stimulus, the events of their environment, were absolutely dreadful? Way beyond someone saying something mean. Way beyond their losing their job. Have you ever been with somebody who's gotten some news that's the worst thing you could imagine? Anyone here ever been with someone who's gotten the news that they're going to die? It's dreadful. Now, I can't imagine a worse stimulus. Has anyone here ever seen someone who has news like that face their death with dignity and grace and strength? I remember the very first day I ever sat with a woman named Jeetan. This is like several years ago. I met her because she had been told by a doctor that she had cancer that was not going to go away and that they wouldn't be able to fix, that she was going to die. That was the stimulus in her environment, that news. I drove over to her home and I was a bit nervous. I sat down with her and I said this. I said, I knew I wanted to go right at it, not dance around the subject. I said, I understand that you just found out that you're going to die and it's going to be pretty soon. And I said, I imagine that's really devastating for you. And she looked up at me and she said, yeah, it could be devastating if I chose to respond in that way. But you know what, Christian? I've decided that that's not how I'm going to respond. I could, if I decided, choose to be angry and bitter about what's happening. I could decide that I'm going to be anxious and worried about when it's going to happen. I could think in my mind about all the things that I'm going to lose and miss out on because I'm going to die. Maybe there's a grandchild I won't meet. Maybe there's some good event ahead of me that won't happen. And I could choose to think about those things and really get miserable about it, but do you know what, Christian? That's not what I'm going to choose to do. Now, I was sitting there thinking, is she just putting it on? Maybe she's just saying this to try to, like, put on a good face. On the other hand, she said, I could choose to be grateful for all that I've been given. I could decide that even though I'm sick right now, I'm not going to focus on all the things that I'll lose, but all the things that I still can do now. I'm going to choose not to wonder about the years that I'll never see, but instead appreciate every single day that I have. She said this right to me. I left that place and I was inspired. I still, honestly, I was a little bit curious. Is she just saying this? I spent time with her over the next several years and I saw that she wasn't just saying this. It became true every time I saw her that she was facing this environment of pain with all of the grace and joy that befitted her as a person who made the choice not to respond to this in a negative way, not to respond to it in a way that would be destructive or worthless, but instead to respond to it in a good way. Even up to the very last time I saw her, she was trying to take care of me, asking me how I was. So she even sent me a thank you card after I visited her, one of the very last times I visited her. She took the time to write a thank you note to me. If any of us here, if any of us buy this silly lie that we can't be humble because it's just too hard when there are so many people around us that make us want to fight back, that we can't be patient because it's just our environment is too demanding, or that it's not possible for us to bear with the people around us in love because they're just too unbearable, or that our circumstances in life make it impossible for us to keep going. We are selling ourselves short as if we were animals and not recognizing that between every stimulus that we will face as human beings, as individuals, and every stimulus that we will face as a church, as a community of Christ been drawn together here in Outreach Red Bank, between every one of those two things, there will be a choice for us. And what we're called to by this letter of Ephesians and by the Master Jesus Christ who we serve is to make the right choices, to choose to walk in the right way. Now, I don't want to leave you with this and just say, now you must go for it and walk worthily under your own steam. Because the truth is that Jean was not able to do that just because she tried to do that. Do you know why she was able to walk worthily? It's because she was walking with someone. There was someone with her and she knew it when she got that news. And there was someone with her when she was facing the decision of how to respond. And there was someone with her every time a deadly thought came into her mind and she considered it and let it hurt her because it did hurt, but then chose how to respond. There was someone with her when the sadness was overwhelming. There was someone with her all the way on every step of the road. And it's true, there's someone with us, whether we want to acknowledge it or not, every time we face a difficult situation as a church, every time we're confronted with the opportunity to respond in the wrong way. And that someone is Jesus. He said to his disciples who were meant to walk worthily, if any one of you is weary or heavy laden, if any one of you is carrying a burden that's too much for you to carry, here's what I want you to do. I want you to come to me and give me your burdens. And Jean was able to walk in that way, which is a worthy way, because she was walking with Jesus and had given him all of those burdens. And we as individuals, whether it's a small thing, like responding to traffic jams or facing the challenges at school or taking on insults, or a bigger thing, like loving people in this community who are really hard to love, or facing some difficult circumstance in life, like the end of a relationship, the loss of someone we love, a future that seems utterly scary, we will be able to walk in the right way, worthily, when we walk with Jesus. When we come to him as he commanded and give him our burdens and then take from him the yoke that he gives. Do you know where this text is that I'm talking about? Come to me, all you who are heavy and weary. Do you know where this is? It's Matthew 11:28. For those of you who are taking notes and want to read that another time, write that down. And write that down on your mental note. That Jesus said, come to me. And if you do, he says, I will take your burdens and I will give you my yoke. Learn from me, Jesus said, because I am humble. Learn from me because I am gentle. He didn't say it there, but he meant it. Learn from me because I'm patient. And because I bear with everyone in love. And because I am going to go all the way to the cross to secure unity for you. And I will allow myself to be the recipient of the judgment of God so that you can have peace. And Jesus Christ, the one who calls us to him, has done all of that. And so, because of that, we can walk worthily of the calling to which he has called us. Will we walk like that? If we walk like that, it will be something that others see. It will be something that we do on purpose, and it will be slow. And I'm certain that the only hope we have is if we will be walking along with Jesus. And we're going to sing together a song that came from that text in Matthew. Now, before that, and as the musicians come up to lead us, I want to close us up in this time of learning together by praying. And I want to ask each one of you to pray.